Today on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa, the new session of the United Nations General Assembly is underway, where African and world leaders address development and security issues, as well as the spreading Ebola crisis. That's coming up next right here on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from New York. Hello, welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa. It's Wednesday, September 24th. I am Shaka Sali, coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in New York.
And hello to you, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I am Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter right here in Washington.
Today, we'll talk about the 69th session of the General Assembly at the United Nations and discuss the concerns of African leaders on how the international body addresses the continent's problems.
Very crowded New York City and a busy week for the attendees, certainly. Coming up later in our STA inbox, our audience have responded to our topic through emails and Facebook comments. We'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
But first, U.S. President Obama addressed world leaders at the 69th United Nations General Assembly on Wednesday. Mr. Obama is continuing to build a coalition against Islamic State militants that have seized large areas of territory in Iraq and Syria. He also reiterated America's efforts to contain the Ebola virus that is attacking West Africa. My colleague Paul Sisco has more.
Less than 48 hours after the U.S. and its Arab nation allies carried out a barrage of airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Iraq and Syria, President Barack Obama addressed over 140 world leaders at the UNGA. He reaffirmed the resolve of the international community to degrade and destroy the Islamic State militants.
We will use our military might in a campaign of airstrikes to roll back ISIL. We will train and equip forces fighting against these terrorists on the ground. We will work to cut off their financing and to stop the flow of fighters into and out of the region. And already over 40 nations have offered to join this coalition. The ideology of ISIL, or Al-Qaeda, or Boko Haram will wilt and die if it is consistently exposed and confronted and refuted in the light of day.
He also urged leaders to recognize and pull together a comprehensive response to the spreading Ebola crisis.
As we gather here, an outbreak of Ebola overwhelms public health systems in West Africa and threatens to move rapidly across borders. Each of these problems demands urgent attention.
The Ebola virus has killed at least 2,800 people, according to the World Health Organization. In a report released on Tuesday, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that if there is nothing done to control the outbreak, there could be 1.4 million cases of Ebola in Liberia and Sierra Leone by the end of January.
We must also fight the virus of fear and misinformation. Bans on travel or transport will not keep Ebola from getting out, but will keep medical personnel and supplies from getting in. We need to isolate people affected by Ebola, but not the nations struggling to cope with it. With the leadership and solidarity, we can help the people of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone bring the outbreak to an end and regain the path to a better future.
Ugandan Sam Kutesa is president of the 69th UN General Assembly.
Without quick and decisive action, the trail of devastation this outbreak leaves behind will reach far beyond the portions of West Africa most affected up to now. Ebola is no longer a sub-regional or even a regional calamity. It is an international crisis.
The Security Council, with an unprecedented 130 sponsors, has adopted a resolution urging all countries to provide health experts and field hospital and medical supplies to contain the spread.
And at this crossroads, I can promise you that the United States of America will not be distracted or deterred from what must be done. We are heirs to a proud legacy of freedom, and we're prepared to do what is necessary to secure that legacy for generations to come. I ask that you join us in this common mission for today's children and tomorrow's. Thank you very much.
Paul Sisko, VOA News.
Thank you so much. Welcome back to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from New York. Now joining us here in our Washington, in our New York studios, is my distinguished guest, Professor Tandika Mukandawire, former director of the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development. Currently, Professor Mukandawire serves as the African Development Chair at the London School of Economics in the United Kingdom. What can I say? I have honestly to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
And Peter Kelote, a reporter for Voice of America's Daybreak Africa, and now the new host of Nightline Africa. He joins us from Washington studios, of course. Well, congratulations, Peter Kelote, for getting a new show.
Thank you very much, Shaka.
How does it feel?
Well, it feels great. I have worked on the show for a number of years now, both as a host, a reporter, and as a producer. So I know the ins and outs of the show intimately very well.
I see. Well, I gather that we are very lucky to get Margaret on the show. So I can safely say that I am now joined by my colleague, Margaret Beshear, Voice of America's United Nations correspondent.
Hey, Shaka.
Good afternoon, Margaret. Good afternoon.
Welcome to New York.
How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to New York, Shaka.
Talk to us, please. Talk to us, Margaret. What is the mood like? Give us a sense. Give us a sense of the mood at the UN Secretariat.
Well, busy day here at the UN Secretariat. I think people are always sort of excited on the first day of school, much like children on the first, on the first day of General Assembly, much like children on the first day of school. Everyone greeting each other, you know, as if they haven't seen each other in a very long time. You see heads of state, kings and such hugging each other in corridors. So it's always sort of a very festive almost feeling, the first day of General Assembly annual debate here.
What about President Barack Obama's speech? How has it been received so far?
Well, full house for his speech. There wasn't much applause during it. Usually there's more applause. It was sort of silent on that front, but I think it speaks to the seriousness of the subject. People were being very attentive. As we heard in the package, he spoke quite a bit about the Islamic State, the threat from extremism. What I thought was interesting was that he spoke directly to the youth in the Arab and Muslim world and urge them to reject sectarianism and extremism. And I think it's very important because we see so many of these young foreign fighters are teenagers, pretty much, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-olds who go off looking for an adventure, think it's a video game or something, and they get caught up in this, you know, extremist ideology. So President Obama really did try to speak to them directly today.
You know, of course, that Straight Talk Africa is targeted to the African audience. Was there anything about, for example, Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram in Nigeria?
He spoke generally about extremist groups. I think he did mention Boko Haram. And, you know, he's going to host this meeting in about 20 minutes on foreign fighters here at the UN. And that will be not just about, you know, Iraq and Syria. It's foreign fighters anywhere. If you go off to fight with Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram and then you try and come home to your home country, the idea is that you would be prosecuted, that there should be laws in place and penalties to people who fight and people who fund the fighters to cut off the money supply too.
I'm afraid I'm being told that time is not our best ally, Margaret, so I guess we'll talk next time.
Okay, Shaka.
Thank you so much. Now we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is on the social networking website, Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa, become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back to our special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from New York. So please, don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
The United Nations General Assembly is the only universal representative body of the UN's five principal organs. UNGA functions include consider and make recommendations to help maintain international peace and security, including disarmament, discuss questions relating to international peace and security, except when a dispute is before the UN Security Council, recommend the peaceful resolution of any situation that might impair friendly relations among nations.
President Obama recently delivered a statement to West Africans in support of the international fight against Ebola.
On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola. Along with our partners around the world, the United States is working with your governments to help stop this disease. If you feel sick with a high fever, you should get help right away. Because with prompt treatment in a medical center, nearly half of patients can recover. Stopping this disease won't be easy, but we know how to do it. You are not alone. Together, we can treat those who are sick with respect and dignity. We can save lives, and our countries can work together to improve public health so this kind of outbreak doesn't happen again. In this urgent work, and in building a stronger and more prosperous Africa, you'll continue to have a partner in me and in the United States of America.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui, and welcome back to a special edition, of course, of Straight Talk Africa, which is coming to you live from here in New York. Now, joining us here again in New York is my distinguished guest. I have the dubious privilege, of course, of introducing you twice, Professor Tandika Mukandawile, the former director of the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development. Currently, Professor Mukandawile serves as the African Development Chair at the London School of Economics in the United Kingdom. Well, I have to say again that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to host you live from New York.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to converse with you.
You're most welcome, sir. And joining us from our Washington studios, of course, is Peter Kilote, the new anchor of Nightline Africa. Peter, again, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Shaka. We're having technical difficulties. I'm finding it difficult to hear you.
I see. Well, I heard you loud and clear. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111, and the US country code is 1. Let me come to you, Professor Mukandawile, immediately. First of all, how does it feel like to be in New York at this
I'm
time?
Not hearing anything
you can
at
see
all.
In Manhattan, of course, you almost have nowhere to pass.
I know, it's amazing. I mean, I have not been here when the General Assembly is on with all the heads of state, although I was in the UN for quite a number of years. So it was quite impressive to see how New York gets shaken up. I mean, the traffic gets shaken up, and I think the second and third street, you could hardly cross the streets. So it's quite an event for New York City.
Isn't that symbolic,
perhaps?
And I also
saw the demonstration that took place on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of the largest demonstrations I've seen in my life.
Isn't that perhaps symbolic of being, in fact, in a city that hosts the United Nations headquarters?
Yeah, it should be. That's one of the prices you have to pay for hosting such an important organization, I suppose.
You worked for the United Nations, so you're pretty much conversant, frankly, with the manner in which it is perceived by the people back in Africa. What kind of reputation does it have?
Well, the UN has gone through, in the African sense, through ups and downs. You know, I remember in the 60s, in my, there was a lot of expectations by African countries, which were shattered by the Congo experience, I think. And then the UN built up again. But generally, the UN is seen, it's seen as a fair, arbitrator, and quite. If you're working for the UN, you do feel in Africa at least that it's a respected organization. Yes. But the UN is not independent of the actual dynamics of nation states. So
especially the five permanent member states that form the Security Council.
Yeah, exactly. So it reflects a lot of the injustices of sharing of power, and that also affects how Africans perceive the UN.
You talked about the 60s, the good old days, some people would say, and that was the time when the UN was under the leadership of one Dag Hammarskjöld.
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, a Ralph Bunche.
Ralph Bunche, exactly. Yes.
Ralph Bunche.
I think in the 60s, Africans saw the UN very much around the issue of liberation, and much of the effort of the Africans in the UN was to use the UN in the struggle for independence, and especially against apartheid later on. Yeah.
Well, what about the fact that, frankly, people expect the UN to play a role that would help African countries to develop?
Yes.
And yet, it seems to me that, at least lately, really, the major role that the UN plays is peacekeeping.
Well, in the peculiar division of labor in the international system, the UN has much less resources for development. Much of the development resources are now going through Washington as opposed to New York and Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
And New York and the UN has taken on a much more normative role, setting up goals and standards, and much less actual directly involvement in the developmental processes.
How do you, for example, feel about the manner in which the UN and the international community have reacted to the Ebola crisis in West Africa?
Well, I'm a little bit afraid that there might be a lot of, spreading of blame and all that. I mean, this is a huge problem, and I think, to be fair to everybody, it's taken everybody by surprise in terms of the speed with which it's growing. And people have complained about how slow the WHO has been, and I'm not really a specialist on that. I have been myself surprised by how little was learned from the experience in the Congo. And that's what's really striking, that how the experience of the Congo and the role of local, of national doctors there was not conveyed to countries in Africa, but how you deal with that when it occurred. So
mm-hmm.
that's my big surprise. I just figured, how come we didn't get any lessons from the Congo, that could have been used in Sierra Leone and Liberia and so forth.
You might also add Uganda.
Sudan. So there have been experiences with that. And I'm just intrigued by how there is no kind of institutional memory about these events. And it just strikes us as if we're acting on something for the first time.
But what does it also say about the fragile nature of the African healthcare system?
Yes, ultimately, that's what it reflects, that, there are just too many people who are outside the health system. And that one of the ways of prevention is actually inclusion of people. If people are included in the health system,
mm-hmm.
These things could be detected. The fact that these people are outside the health system is a reflection of what has gone wrong in the African health and the health system.
Any particular reasons why African leaders, frankly, when it comes to that issue, they look like they're being insensitive to their own people?
Well, I don't know how to speak, how one can say that. I think, look, this is a big surprise in many ways. It's a big disease. And the African health systems in general are very weak. So I don't think it's simply a question of attitudes of African government. I think just that you have very weak health systems. And in the last 20, 30 years, through eras of structural adjustment and all that, the public health system suffered a lot because there was a movement towards a more private provision of health services, and the middle class sort of were pulling out of the public health systems. So in a sense, we are faced with the systems which are generally weak for all kinds of reasons. Now, whether African governments are being indifferent or I don't think it's a fair comment on them. I think they probably are standards, all of us, and not quite sure what to do.
What about some who will point a finger at the Bretton Woods institutions and in fact say, look at the role of the World Bank's structural adjustment programs?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to establish a simple causal relationship, but the fact of the matter is that the health systems in Africa suffered a lot during structural adjustment because there was a very strong push towards a private health provision, and the public health services suffered a lot. You know? And then you add on those whole question of brain drain that took place during that phase when doctors left. It's a general problem Africa is facing, that we are, after 20, 30 years of maladjustment, many of our institutions are not functioning properly. And when they're hit with a crisis like this, it's quite obvious that we have, something has gone profoundly wrong, you know, in terms of institutional development in Africa.
You know, it was, I think, Professor Einstein who said that if you keep doing the same thing, expecting different results.
Yes, yes.
Maybe you might be actually insane.
of course, there was a problem in the 80s and 90s, the so-called consensus. The consensus did tend to produce the same solution for all countries.
The Washington consensus?
Yes, and it took often, it was difficult to correct that. You know, it was such a powerful consensus by the powerful that, and no amount of evidence that it was not working actually, you know, could bring the consensus down until, you know, when the financial crisis hit, the West, that then we began to see some serious rethink about this consensus. But it's remarkable that, you know, these institutional reforms were pretty much, standard reforms replicated, in different parts of Africa.
I see. Well, Peter, are you there?
Shaka?
Yeah, have you been following the conversation?
I have, Shaka. I have been following the conversation very well.
Well, I know that you've been doing a lot of reporting on the African continent, and of course, the issue of this fragile healthcare system on the continent in general. What do you think that governments in Africa need to be doing, really? Because the last time I checked, frankly, someone could accuse them of being socially and politically insensitive to their own people, the people that they claim to lead.
Well, Shaka, from what I have gathered from both journalists and health officials, as well as officials of government in the region and on the continent, they seem to appear that criticisms are being leveled against the leaders of these nations because, one, they appear not to build infrastructure in terms of health infrastructure to handle such instances of outbreak. When they get sick, the accusation is that they leave their homes and go abroad to seek medical treatment, leaving their people to face whatever broken health system they have back home. And that is one of the accusations. And secondly, some of these countries deny if there is any outbreak at all. First they deny, then they come up and tell you there are solutions being implemented to ensure that some of these issues are resolved. But then when you ask the doctors and health groups that are in the country, as well as civil society groups, about what pragmatic measures the government have been putting in place to resolve these issues, they tell you there's none in existence. Yet, the case of Ebola is a clear case. Some of these countries that were hit, they said there are no cases of Ebola in their countries. 2-3 weeks later, there are several. And then it begins to exponentially magnify the problem. And then you ask these same government officials what they're doing and why they denied it from the onset. You know, they will give you varying, reasons. But the problem is, the health institutions have not been able to cope with the enormity of the problems of the outbreak. And that has to be redressed, and that is a challenge to them.
Peter, what do you think the ordinary African citizen can do in order to make their governments begin to deliver services to them, really? Because let's face it, there's an interesting story of an African president from the East African region who had the audacity to send his daughter, who was pregnant, to go and give birth in Germany with a presidential jet to boot. I mean, when you see a lot of women in that particular country, when they are in the situation of giving birth, you find them, frankly, being treated as if they were less than human beings.
Well, Shaka, some countries, civil society groups in some countries have started this phenomenon where they are putting pressure on the administration and leaders of these governments to be more accountable to their people. And they have been educating the masses about their rights and responsibilities under these new democratic dispensation. Unfortunately, their work sometimes have been curtailed because some of them are being harassed. They claim they are being harassed by some government officials who have power and who have the government machinery behind them. But then some of them are also being accused of being agents of the West to undermine the stability and cohesion of the country. And some of them are being asked to re-register as a means of intimidation. However, I believe that if there's a genuine cooperation between civil institutions, civil rights organizations, and the government to educate the masses about what needs to be done to hold them accountable, because they run the country because they were voted for. However, they rule like kings and queens with decrees and with no accountability. So I believe if citizens are educated enough, they will be able to hold their leaders accountable to their actions. I hope it happens soon.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Noah from Tanzania. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Noah, I'm afraid I cannot hear you. Who is that? Is that Noah? Hello, Juma.
This is Juma from Tanzania.
Yes, please. What is your question or observation?
Well, my concern is how we have seen the Western countries, they were concentrating on issues of Ebola. We have seen how the Western countries trying to force the African leaders to follow what they want, especially on the issue of homosexuals. But at the same time, when African countries are in trouble, especially the third world countries, we are seeing that women and children are suffering. Why should the Western countries not take action to assist both in good and in problems which they are facing Africans, instead of trying to tell them to follow what they want? That is the concern, Mr. Shaka.
Thank you very, very much. We'll come to you a little bit later because time happens not to be our best ally. You're tuned into a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, which is coming to you live from our New York studios. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment, but first here is Mariama Jaro. Take it away, Mariama.
Well, still to come, we'll reveal some of the outstanding and quite passionate feedback we've received from our audience through social media. But now, here is our letter of the week from a Facebook fan who responded to our question of the week.
Mohamedina Jakana from Liberia writes, "The UN is not the only institution that can solve Africa's problems, nor is it a transparent institution. Africa's problems can be solved by Africans, and African governments don't have to wait for UN intervention. Africa has all the resources and capabilities to improve. It needs democracy, responsible leadership, good governance, respect for the rule of law, and no dictatorships.
Sia Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
I would want the people in West Africa to know that Ebola is real. Ebola kills. Early detection and prompt treatment can save lives. And I'm asking our people not to victimize or stigmatize survivors. Ebola is a challenge, but together we'll all be able to overcome it.
That was Sia Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaking to VOA Africa on the Ebola crisis.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to keep your questions brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from New York. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and special media reporter, Mariama. Take it away again, Mariama.
Well, a number of very important issues are being discussed as we speak at this year's UN General Assembly. Topping the African agenda is the Ebola crisis, terrorism, poverty, and preserving the environment as key part of the Millennium Development Goals, which are set to expire in 2015. This leads us to our question of the week, asking, what steps should the UN take to become more effective as an institution to help Africa solve its problems? Well, thanks everyone for using all our social media platforms to tell us what you really think about the various topics we cover. We'll begin with a comment from Deodatus Shayo from Tanzania, who writes, African states should implement the great ideas from its iconic political leaders like Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and Julius Nyerere from Tanzania, who were focused on uniting Africa. Dependency on international bodies like the UN is not the best practice, and so far, it is not working. Let Africa build its own capacity and patriotic leaders. Well, another comment comes from Isaac Mwanza in Zambia, who says, we need radical reforms at the UN to allow broader representation of Africa on the Security Council. The UN must also focus on Africa's human development, helping it manage its own resources to ensure greater accountability. We need a UN that is relevant to Africa's modern challenges. Well, Shaka, a little nostalgia here with the mention of late African leaders like Nkrumah and Nyerere, but also some straight talk, no pun intended, about broader representation on the Security Council, something that many African leaders have tried to address over the years, but doesn't seem to go anywhere. And I think you guys have alluded to that earlier as well.
Very interesting, Professor. You know that before we came to the studio, in fact, over lunch, we were talking about what happened to African leadership, especially if you compare the current leadership and contrast it with the founding fathers. We talked about the Osagyefo, Dr. Yeah. Kwame Nkrumah. We talked about Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere.
Well, yeah, I mean, the difference in quality is enormous. I mean, just even just in the moral attributes of these people. I mean,
in what sense?
The first leaders, almost all of them, died with no money. You know, they left. They didn't steal money. They were just.
Why did they have to have money? I mean, they were serving their people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was
the
first.
And the people were supporting
but
them.
If you compare that now to the next generation, who the Mobutus of the world, and who made billions of dollars. I mean, when I think Nkrumah left with something $12,000, you know, from his royalties. So that's. So there is a difference in terms of a commitment to some idea, and we have now a relationship to power that is much more materialistic, much more highly individualized, and that is hopefully with the strengthening of democracies, we can weed out some of these these very burdensome leaders on the continent.
What about the issue of UN reforms? I mean, we hear, for example, at least three of the permanent members of the Security Council talking about democracy.
Yes, yes.
And yet, they happen, in fact, to be beneficiaries of an institution that is undemocratic.
Yes.
Especially the Security Council is undemocratic, exactly. Even though one could actually argue that the General Assembly is democratic.
Yeah, I mean, look, you have to remember that when most of these things were set up, most of the countries in Africa were colonies. And we were seen almost like as a nuisance when we began coming in, because the global system is extremely unequal. I mean, it's probably naive to expect that the UN alone would be equal or democratic when the whole structure, from the IMF, World Bank, the financial system is extremely unequal. And the UN in many ways reflects these global inequalities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Mariama, do you have any more feedback to share with our audience, please?
Yes, indeed. We'll move on to a very critical posting from Sylvester Menjo from Kenya, who writes, how can the UN solve Africa's problems when it was strategically set up to guard the political interests of the West? The UN should stop being used as a fire extinguisher by Western powers after setting African countries on fire. Look at the conflicts in Libya, Sudan, Chad, Nigeria, Central African Republic, and the DRC. Who is benefiting? Who is supplying the arms that are terrorizing innocent lives? These cases should propel Africa to chart its own destiny. Well, while we're at it, we're going to take a look at another one, this time from Patricia Namdi in Uganda, who says, the UN should ensure that there is respect for human rights in African countries. It should also work better with the powerful nations to curtail terrorism, which has affected African states. The UN should help negotiate fair prices for African raw materials on the world market. It should also condemn corruption, dictatorship, and nepotism that have rendered many African economies stagnant. Well, the comments are very, very packed with a lot of ideas and some very harsh criticism. Shaka?
Thank you very much. What about that, Peter Kilote?
Had similar instances of criticisms against our leaders, and some of them have said that the UN institutions should be revamped or should be reorganized. Now, there have been several instances of promises that the UN institution has to be reorganized, but it's been decades and it's the status quo remains. So it remains to be seen what benefit the observers say that Africans get from these UN General Assembly. The critics say that the African leaders make very fine, lofty speeches at the UN General Assembly, but there's absolutely nothing tangible to show for it when they come back home. So they think that it's a waste of money to send these heads of state there with a huge delegation, although some supporters argue that there are businesses that are conducted on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, but they said there's nothing to show for it. So there's no need why hard-earned cash that the government does not have should be used for them to just make speeches and return home empty-handed.
Well, thanks very much, Mariama, for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
Well, that will do it for today's social media segment. Thanks to our guests for responding to our audience. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please, please keep them coming. And if you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords, Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. Or you can join our YouTube channel. Simply subscribe to VOA TV to Africa. Well, now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Chigongo Eric James, his story from poverty to success, the African author, motivational speaker, and media owner, joins us next week right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back on today's special edition of Straight Talk Africa. We are coming to you live from New York. They call it the Big Apple, of course, as the 69th General Assembly is underway at the United Nations and discussing the concerns of African leaders on how the international body addresses the continent's problems. Our distinguished guests are Professor Tandika Mukandawire, the former director of the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development. Currently, Professor Mukandawire serves as the African Development Chair at the London School of Economics in the United Kingdom. And last but not least, Peter Clote, reporter for The Voice of America's Daybreak Africa, and now the new anchor or host of Nightline Africa. He joins us from our Washington studios. Well, gentlemen, I have to say frankly that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. Now, we heard earlier about issues regarding these annual conferences. Are they justified, Professor? You know, each year you have most heads of states congregating in New York. And when they go back, they will have spent a lot of their taxpayers' money. And when they go back, what do they go back with?
Well, we are members of the UN, so it's not. So we have to find ways of participating in these organizations. And we may argue about the size of delegations and the competence of the people in the delegation, but we obviously have to be there. And I think we shouldn't confuse this fact of wrong delegations or expensive delegations and the fact that Africans have to participate. This is the only global governance structure that we have. And we may not be doing very well in terms of our how efficient we are in our participation in these organizations. I think that we are much less organized than we should be. And so the African voice gets somehow muffled because of the lack of our strategic thinking. We don't have arms, but we can at least use our diplomatic and political skills to try to put forward the African position in the UN system. But there is no, if we don't come there, the few people who have money will be deciding on every, who will be deciding on our participation. So we shouldn't really confuse the costs incurred by individual governments. I mean, some delegations are obviously crazy. I mean, where the sort of things that take place at the UN do not require those huge delegations.
I mean, tell me, for example, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom,
yes,
he flies on British Airways, first class,
yes,
from Heathrow to JFK. He lives in a hotel where he pays less than $5,000 a night. A president in Central Africa flies in a presidential jet. His people are poor. In fact, his the salary of his public servants and what have you are paid for by the so-called development partners.
Yes.
He sleeps in a hotel of $20,000 in Manhattan. And when he's being asked about why does he do that, he says, wait a minute, I don't want anyone to be questioning me because I used to sleep in tents, I used to sleep in trenches. What about that?
That's obscene, isn't it? I mean, that's all you can say. I mean, it's obscene, and in many ways, fortunately, I think what's happening now, but maybe it will change. I'm a little optimistic in saying that the media, I'm from Malawi, and there's been a big debate about Malawi delegation coming to the UN, and people calculate how much per diems have been incurred, and their figures produced. I don't know whether they're accurate or not, but the fact is that at least for the first time, the social media is keeping track of these things, and I think we need more exposure of these obscene differences, where countries which are basically very poor countries display wealth that does not reflect in the conditions of their own people.
Conspicuous consumption. or and compensatory consumption.
It's more than conspicuous. This is obscene.
Interesting. Interesting. A reminder that you are tuned into a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, which is coming to you live from New York. As the UN General Assembly is underway, if you wish to participate in our discussion, please call us at 202-619-3111. This country code is 1. We'll continue our discussion in a moment, so please, don't go away.
Let's take a look at the UN Millennium Development Goals. There are 8 challenges the UN hopes to achieve by 2015. Eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality and empower women, reduce child mortality, improve maternal health, combat HIV and AIDS and other diseases, ensure environmental sustainability, and establish a global partnership for development.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook. Keywords, Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui. I gather that the caller from Somalia, the line dropped. Let me take you to a situation where I met an African lady the other day. And she is from East Africa, an African country that should remain anonymous. Guess what? She actually flew to New York to come and have an audience with her president. Her president could not meet her at home. And this is not an isolated incident because I have met a lot of people. Why? Why are these leaders really disconnected from their own people?
Well, that is a very, I honestly have no idea how that happened. It sounds so bizarre that an appointment would have to take place so far from home. It may happen, actually, that sometimes heads of state are more accessible when they're outside. I mean, they're more welcoming when they're outside, and they behave differently outside than, they will talk to the, they will engage in open discussions with the citizens who are abroad, and not do the same thing with those at home. There are all these, incongruences of how leaders behave, in different spaces. But this case of having to fly all the way to New York to meet your head of state is unfortunate.
But
to say the least.
But you even have situations where you have senior government officials,
yes,
cabinet ministers, who never get a chance to interact or talk or even on the telephone with their president. You have ambassadors, I have been told by some of the ambassadors, frankly, who have been assigned to certain countries to represent their head of state. And for 2-3 years, never.
Met
no access. And yet, when an ordinary foreigner, especially from European, North American countries, goes to Africa.
Well, that's a long story in Africa. I mean, the number of times you meet young colleagues from Europe who go to a country and come back and report, I had an audience with the president. So of course, that's one of the problems. But that sense of alienation of leadership doesn't do them any good. I mean, I don't know whether they think that being cut off from the people enhances their status, but definitely doesn't do them much good. I mean, if a good leadership should involve at least your ability to make your project part of people's common sense. That is, people accept your project. If you're trying to build a nation, that it becomes part of people's project until you do that by communicating to your people, I mean, and sharing the ideas and your aspirations with your people. So if they are behaving in, you know, in this very strange, isolated mode, the consequence of that is that whatever project they had, if they have any, won't have any national anchoring and therefore won't succeed.
What advice would you give those of us in journalism, for example, to address some of these people that you continuously refer to as leaders? The last time I checked, frankly, maybe I'm eminently underqualified to define leadership, because after all, I didn't go to the prestigious United Kingdom universities and stuff like that. But I'm very lucky to be breathing the same air with a professor at one of the best, one of the top. Should we be regarding those types of people as leaders or as rulers, really?
Well, look, the term leadership in this case refers to your head of a state. You're head of state, and people say a head of state is a leader.
Head of government?
Yeah, you may just be, as we said, a ruler and not really providing proper leadership. What the press can do, and I think is doing increasingly better today than it did, say, 20 years ago, is to expose some of these, you know, potentates that are not really leaders. I mean, that is, I was just watching quite recently a documentary on the rise and fall of Mobutu. And I said to myself, how was this allowed to happen, you know, when you think about it? I mean, totally comical. Phenomenal.
But isn't it happening as we talk now?
Yes. So the only solution to such terrible behavior is mockery. You know, exposure and mockery. You know, and that is an effective tool against such. You know, such. And today the media allows that. There's the internet, so it allows that, and that they have to learn that. You know, if they're making fools of themselves, I'd expose that to be the case, that this is, you know, it's a foolish behavior.
Peter, what about you? What is your experience? You've been covering the continent for many, many years now. You have interacted with lots of the type of leaders that we are talking about. Is there something that, for example, again, ordinary people can do in order to assert their citizenship status, that they do, in fact, have rights? Because they owe allegiance to the state, that they have rights that you'd call inalienable or, in fact, birthrights. They are not subjects. Subjects owe allegiance to an individual authority, and that individual authority grants them privileges but not rights.
Well, Shaka, I hope things change, because there have been only a handful of countries that I have been privy to where citizens go on demonstrations, they put pressure on the administration to answer to some of their demands or questions about ills they think undermine the well-being of the ordinary man and woman in those countries. Some journalists, unfortunately, are chased out of the country. A case is in, I'm not going to mention the country's name, but it's in West Africa where journalists are usually being hounded around. And the head of state will come and say, well, if you don't follow my rules, you better get out of the country, else I'll be coming for you. Fortunately, a handful of countries are opening the space for dialogue, where they at least hear the concerns being expressed to them and they try to come up with solutions. Sometimes just having a dialogue is enough to resolve some of the concerns and to take pragmatic steps to address them. Unfortunately, it's not enough. And those are issues that need to be addressed from going forward, Shaka.
Thank you very much. I gather that we are lucky to be receiving a call from the United Kingdom. Good evening, Hassan. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Shaka, my name is Alphonse.
Hello. Who?
Hello. Alphonse.
Okay. Go for it.
Yeah, I'm calling from the United Kingdom. I just want to talk about the question of the week, which was asking what the United Nations can do in order to help Africa solve its problems.
What is the question?
I just want to contribute. Hello?
Yes, please. Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I was trying to say is just regarding what the question of the week was actually talking about, which is what the United Nations can do in order to help Africa solve its problems. My contribution would be United Nations, because it seems like it's a bit one-sided. The whole of Africa, we actually don't have much say in the United Nations. So I think in order for the United Nations to help Africa solve its problem, we need to have people who are from Africa who are actually part of the decision-making process. Like if you look at the veto power and the rest of it, Africa actually hasn't got a say. And sometimes when the UN wants to vote in order to go to a war, we don't have a say. And then, like I was saying the other time, we have many wars in Africa, and then we Africans don't have a say. So let's say if the UN was going to vote to send troops to Africa, you know, Africa wouldn't be able to say anything, and the problem is actually happening in Africa. It's only the five permanent members who can actually decide. If they choose not to send, if they feel it's not
leveled.
Important to, hello?
The field is not leveled. I think your point is well made. Let me come to the good professor from the nearby London School of Economics. Five permanent members of the Security Council.
Yes, yes.
You have, of course, two European nations, the United Kingdom and France. You might even add Russia, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
And then, of course, you have China, and then you have the United States. You have India, which has more than a billion human beings, is not represented. You have Africa, which is a billion people also plus, not represented. Is that fair?
No, it's not fair at all. I mean, but I said this is a reflection of how the Second World War was settled, and they maintained that. I mean, you know, these were the colonial powers, and you know, and they decided they would be, you know, that is the order. It's an extremely unfair and order. And
but yeah. Japan, China was admitted in the 1970s, representing, of course, Taiwan.
Yeah, because particularly, you know, you can't ignore China. China is organized. I mean, Africa is not organized. We're not really we are not organizing ourselves to assert ourselves globally. You know? And China, was a force. And you know, you can't keep China. That is, you can't keep out China. I mean, the system for Kandek Africa, we were colonies, and in some of the, when you read some of the writing on the setting up of the Bretton Woods institution.
Yes.
The kinds of racist remarks that were made about Africans coming into these organizations, as if we would mess up.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be Abis Alai, good professor. Yeah. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Professor Tandika Mukandawire, the former director of the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development, and currently the African Development Chair at the London School of Economics in the United Kingdom. And Peter Kelote, reporter of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa, and now the new host and anchor of Nightline Africa, who joined us from our Washington studios. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, please. And remember to keep the African hopes alive.
I'm Vincent McCory from Africa 54. This is VOA. Follow us on Africa 54. Go to facebook.com/VOA Africa 54.